about as working on LGBTQ issues. I saw that that headline quote has been getting a lot of press. But then I remembered that Pope Francis, before he became Pope, also gave an interview in which he condemned same-sex marriage. He called it a machination of the devil and a father of lies. And so what I'm trying to point out is that the Pope Francis who was elected in 2013 is not the Pope Francis who we buried in 2025. And that when Pope Francis and now Pope Leo made those remarks about LGBTQ issues, they made them under the pontificate of Benedict XVI. The church has changed since then. The church has moved. Pope Francis has moved and evolved, and I have to believe that Pope Leo has also changed and evolved since then. So I'm going to be waiting with eagerness to see just how far he's evolved and how far he's moved. And so I want to just caution, especially LGBT Catholics who are looking at what he said back in 2012, Pope Leo XIV said back in 2012, to not necessarily assume that that's his position now in 2025.
When I watched him today in the Sistine Chapel addressing the cardinals, there were two women who did readings. They were first.
Yes.
The significance of this, because obviously this was his choice.
Obviously. And I think with understanding the Catholic Church, symbolism is a telegraph. It's a smoke signal. It's telling you something. And I think that we have to understand that this man is going to be in marked continuity with the initiatives of Pope Francis, that he wants to continue to advance the position of women. Now, I think we need to understand that these guys are not progressives as we would understand them in the American vernacular. But the Catholic Church is a global church, an ancient church, and it moves slowly. Pope Francis opened doors, and I think that it's up to Pope Leo now to help the church to continue to walk through those doors, especially in the advancement of women and LGBTQ issues. Mm-hmm.
I want to bring our next guest into this conversation. He's back in Rome, Italy, Peter Isley. He is a survivor of sexual assault by a Catholic priest as a 13-year-old boy growing up in Wisconsin. Peter's one of the founders and global affairs chief of SNAP, Survivors Network of Those Abused by Priests. SNAP's open letter in response to the new pope, quote, highlights the grim reality underpinning the College of Cardinals. Many who voted in this conclave actively shielded abusers, and many who will be appointed to the curia under this papacy bear similar stains, they write. Peter Isley, can you talk about your organization's very grave concerns about Cardinal Prevost being elected a pope?
Yeah, and you can imagine how difficult this is for me to be sitting here for survivors to what they're experiencing today, especially when survivors from Peru and some of the United States who were raped and sexually assaulted by Augustinians, the order that Prevost was provincial of, and then global, ahead of the global order, what it felt like to see him walk out on that balcony knowing that your family, you, your life is permanently changed because of how he has managed or mismanaged sexual abuse cases. It's hard not to be a part of the Leo fan club right now. I'm pretty confident I'm the most unpopular person, probably in Rome right now, and certainly on this panel. But here are the facts, and this is why we were in Rome launching a conclave watch. People need to know what the records on sexual abuse and cover-up are of these cardinals. And we filed a vos estis complaint. That's the official mechanism that you're supposed to use when a bishop has evidence of covering up sex crimes. And in that filing, there is plenty of evidence. Now, I'm not saying he's guilty, but we're saying it reaches well beyond probable cause that he covered up sex crimes as Augustinian provincial and as head of the Augustinian order, and then as a bishop in Peru from 2014 to 2023. And the worst is a case that he was directly involved in, three sisters who were sexually assaulted and raped by two priests in his diocese. They were like 6 and 7 years old. The statute of limitations in Peru for child sex crimes is 4 years. So they didn't go to the police by, you know, they 9 years old. They didn't go to the police. But they did it, and one of them admitted it. He admitted to the church that he committed these heinous, awful crimes against these girls. And what Prevost did with that information is that he didn't launch and, you know, give it to justice officials, say, in Peru to find out if there's any possibility of prosecution. He took that criminal evidence like they do all around the world, and he shipped it via diplomatic pouch over here to the Vatican over here. What are they doing with it? And that case was closed because of the civil statute in Peru. The man has sexually assaulted children. They were left in ministry. These victims had to go public. Imagine the courage of these three women. Women, they didn't get to read the gospel today or whatever what happened over there, but these three women raped and sexually assaulted by two Peruvian priests. Prevost, I'm sorry. I hate saying this. I hate saying this. The evidence is they covered up these crimes.
Peter, I wanted to go to a clip.
Headquarters,
I wanted to go to a clip, by the way. This recent scrutiny centering around Cardinal Robert Prevost's alleged awareness and mishandling of accusations of sexual abuse against two priests when Prevost, now the Pope, was the Archbishop, as you described, in Peru. This is a clip of Ana Maria Quispe, a Peruvian woman who you were talking about, who accused the two priests, Eleuterio Vasquez and Ricardo Yasquen, of sexual abuse. In an interview with the Peruvian media in 2023, she said the abuse started when she was 9 years old.
Lo que me pasó a mí fue alrededor del 2007. Yo en ese entonces...
What happened to me was around 2007. At the time, the priest would invite us to celebrations, to go on missions, to pray the rosary with him, or to mass. He would insist in having youth go on missions with him, to rural regions in the mountains. After so much insistence, my parents agreed because the priest and I were really close. When it was time to go to bed, he ended up sleeping with me. It was something I didn't expect, and it was very uncomfortable. In regards to Father Ricardo Yasquen, I attended a youth missionary group with him. I was standing in line to greet him when he kissed me. He sat me on top of his legs and he kissed me.
So there is the clip of Ana Maria Quispe, the Peruvian woman accusing two priests of sexual abuse. If you can talk further, Peter, as you sit there in Rome, what your demands are at this point, and if you've ever spoken to the current Pope, to Pope Leo XIV.
No, I've never spoken to him. I don't know if any survivor has spoken to him. He hasn't tweeted anything from survivors, as far as I know. I mean, here's what we wanted from him. Here's what he needs to do. One, he needs to pass, not a policy, a law, a canon law, that's what governs the Catholic Church, a zero-tolerance law. And what that means is simple. Any cleric, any priest, known, determined, like these priests were known and determined, to have committed acts of sexual abuse, violence, rape, assault against a child, will be permanently removed from the Catholic priesthood. He can no longer be a priest. He can't function as a priest. He can't represent himself as a priest. That zero tolerance right now around the world. You can be a bishop. You can have priests, and they know of these priests who have raped and sexually assaulted children. And you can stay in the ministry. You can transfer them to new assignments. And that's perfectly legal under this church law. Secondly, he needs to tell us how he has handled these cases. There needs to be an independent body, not hired by the church, not hired by him, that's going to look into the abuse archives that he's involved with. So when he was Augustinian provincial, when he was head of the Augustinian order, right now we're in the Augustinian headquarters. Those files might be right here. They might be like three floors down from me. Those need to be reviewed. What cases did he handle? Because every case of an Augustinian during that time of rape and sexual assault, and there were cases, went to him he was responsible for. And in Peru, all that time in Peru, every case in his diocese he was responsible for. That needs to be examined. He needs to be transparent. He needs to be honest. Let's open the archives and see what he's done. Even with the case, by the way, this victim, her other two sisters then came forward with her. It's not just her. It's just her and her two sisters, for God's sake. Let's see the report he sent to Rome that has led to the closing of this case. And then finally, the last job he had was head of the Dicastery of Bishops.
all the reports of bishops that have covered up sex crimes, guess where they're supposed to go? Guess where Vos Estes is supposed to be instituted? Over there with him. So he knows of all the, any reports of bishops that have covered up sex crimes or cardinals. Those files are over there. So he needs to open up those archives, because believe me, we want to trust him. Right now, there is no indication when it comes to this that he can be trusted. I am the last person that wants to say this. Do you know how difficult this is for me to say with all the praise and adulation and glory? I agree with many of the positions that the other two guests talked about. I agree with that. But just because I criticize Pope Leo, and just because we had the same problem with Francis covering up sex crimes, that does not make us J.D. Vance. That does not make us conservatives because, oh, God, you know, we're criticizing Pope Leo. And I'm sorry to get so worked up about this, but it is extraordinarily difficult to be in these conversations right now.
Can I respond, Amy?
Yes. James Grimaldi, executive editor of National Catholic Reporter, who's sitting next to Peter Eisele in the studio in Rome, if you could respond.
Yeah. First, I want to say that there is no media organization in the world that has done more to expose sexual abuse by priests than the National Catholic Reporter. That's number one. We gave our database of abusers to SNAP and Bishop Accountability. That's why they have a database. So I just wanted to make that point. Second, I'm from Missouri, Amy. You got to show me. And I think Peter's a nice man, like Peter a lot, but he's conflated a number of things. The cases that he's talking about are horrific. They're awful. Those priests should be banished from the Catholic Church. We agree on that. No question whatsoever. The question that I don't have, the evidence that I don't have, and when I met Peter the other night, I asked him to send it to me. And in fact, I emailed him the next day and I said, give me that evidence on Prevost, because he was on our short list. We thought he could become the next pope. And I didn't get a reply. Now, he's here in Rome. I didn't have his card. I sent it through their website. So it could be that for whatever happened, and a million things going on, and I'm running a team of seven people, but I'm still eager to see the evidence, because you got to show me that his fingerprints are on a cover-up, and we don't have that. Third, I agree with a lot of that he just said, and we don't know if Pope Leo is going to agree or not. I hope he does, because I am a lifelong, as you know, Amy, after having exposed Jack Abramoff, the corrupt lobbyist, I'm all in favor of transparency and openness. And Francis made some steps in that direction. Did he go far enough? No. Could Pope Leo go further? Yes. Could, you know, I'm with Peter. Let's go downstairs and look through the archives. I love archives. If those archives are here, they should open them up. I want to see exactly what happened. So all of the things he's talking about, and the canon law change, which he mentioned to me the other night, I think this is a great idea. We have no evidence yet that he isn't going to do that. And I agree with our priest friend that we had on a minute ago. You know, something he said 13 years ago, how do we know it hasn't changed? I mean, people's minds change. As you know, Amy, as you know very well, Amy Coney Barrett allegedly told Senator Susan Collins she would not overturn Roe v. Wade because she believed in stare decisis. How did that work out? Well, people change their minds, and we don't know what's going to happen with Pope Leo. So I would say wait and see. Don't listen to what they say. Watch what they do.
So I'm going to give you right there, Peter, the last 30 seconds, and then to Father Brian Massengale for a final comment here. But what I want to do is have the two of you back on as you review the evidence, because this is obviously an ongoing conversation, Peter.
Did you hear the victim talking? They did an open letter. Do you know what guts it took to put their names on a letter that they released to the public with their names on it? They're the ones that said they went to Prevost. Let's see the report Prevost sent. I am talking and believing the victims. Their accounts are completely consistent.
I believe there are the two victims, too.
Please let me finish, sir, okay? And you never sent me the email.
I did.
Okay, fine. Okay, let me finish, please. And the thing is, please respect the fact whether you disagree with me or not, that I am a survivor of rape and sexual assault by a priest in the Catholic Church. And what I'm thinking about is that young lady in Peru and her sisters and what they are going through right now, seeing the praise and adulation of this man. He covered up those crimes in Peru. There's plenty of evidence for an investigation. He did it in Chicago. And this is a court records. He put two priests in residences, one next to a high school, pedophile priest, one next to an elementary school, pedophile priest. He didn't even tell the parents of those children or the principal of that school, I've got a pedophile priest like 1,000 feet away from your school, okay? Didn't do any of that. So that's not the care of children. I'll tell you finally, he was out on that balcony. Did you hear one word to victims of sexual crimes and violence in the Catholic Church? All about peace. Peace is about ending violence. And so the violence he can end, I don't know what he can do about the Ukraine and anything else, but he can end the sexual violence in the church. Pass that zero tolerance now law. He knows what it is. It's been drafted. Pass it and let's see the archives. There's plenty of evidence. Maybe you can ask him. I mean, you seem to be good friends with him. Let's go get archives.
I've never met him. I want to see your evidence, Jay Grimaldi.
I said it. Go up. Go to.
I'm going to give you my email, Peter.
You said you did that before. Go to
Jay Grimaldi at ncronline.org.
Okay, great. We're going to have to leave it there. We're going to have to leave it there, but we're going to continue. Continue this conversation because it's clearly an absolutely critical one. I want to thank Peter Eisele, as you, the two of you also pat each other on the back there. You're clearly both interested in the investigation of this and getting to the bottom of it. Peter Eisele is the survivor of sexual assault by a Catholic priest when he was growing up in Wisconsin and the founder, one of the founders of SNAP, the Survivors Network of Those Abused by Priests. And I also want to thank James Grimaldi, executive editor of the National Catholic Reporter. We have a date to put the two of you back on the show, but I want to get a final comment from our guest here in New York. You may not be in Rome, but you have a lot to say about this as we look at the future of the new pope, Reverend Brian Massengale. What do you want to see?
I guess I want to see a couple of things. I want the Pope to be a voice for the voiceless. What we see around the world and in our own country is rising intolerance, the scapegoating of the migrant and the immigrant. We are seeing the erasure of trans people from our public lives. We're seeing the revision of our histories. We're trying to edit Harriet Tubman out of the Underground Railroad, all in the name of DEI. And this is only in this country. We know that populist nationalisms are increasing around the world. We need this Pope to be a voice for the voiceless. We also need the Pope to be a moral conscience for the world. There are so few leaders of global leaders of moral integrity. And I was pleased to see that he was taking on J.D. Vance, but we need him to step into that void of moral and ethical leadership that we have in our world right now. And we also need the Pope to be a prophet of hope. In these uncertain times, we haven't talked about climate change. And I think one of the things that being from Peru, and he sees that that climate change is threatening the existence of entire island nations around the world. We're seeing people in our own country that are wrestling with growing uncertainty, and we see how that uncertainty is being weaponized by public leaders. We need someone who can be an articulate voice of hope.
I want to thank you so much for being with us. Father Brian Massengale, professor of theological and social ethics at Fordham University here in New York. Recent article for the monthly Catholic magazine America headlined Pope Francis and the Future of Catholic Moral Theology. We will link to that. When we come back, we'll also go to Memphis, where a jury has acquitted three former Memphis police officers in the killing of Tyree Nichols. And hear from a woman in Gaza as we approach Mother's Day.
Good evening, people. How do you do? I'd like to spend a little time with you, talking about how long how long, tell me how long. I am Tyrone, here I stand. All day long I'm your post office man.
Blues by the legendary singer and activist Barbara Dane, our Democracy Now! Studio. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. In his last public appearance before his death, Pope Francis addressed Easter Sunday Mass and repeated his call for a ceasefire in Gaza. As his final gift, Pope Francis donated one of his Popemobiles to be turned into a mobile health care unit for children in Gaza. He gave his blessing to the initiative before his death. As Mother's Day is celebrated here in the U.S. on Sunday, thousands of children in Gaza, many under the age of five, are at imminent risk of dying of starvation due to Israel's total blockade of food, water, medical supplies, and other vital aid. According to UNICEF, more than 9,000 children have been admitted for treatment for acute malnutrition so far this year. This week, we reached out to Duha Latif, a teacher from Gaza, mother of two young children, spoke to her last year when she was trying to evacuate from Rafah with her family. She's now living in a tent in Khan Yunis for displaced people.
Hello, I'm Duha Latif. I'm a mother for two children, Amir, 8 years, and Karim, 3 years. I was once a teacher of simple trust and gentle hopes. Now I'm a witness to the slow collapse of existence. A year ago, I appeared on Democracy Now! When I was still in our home in Rafah City. That day, I spoke to you about our hope for evacuation, and I believe that my second appearance would be from a safe place, a warm home or a balcony overlooking an ordinary life. But today I speak to you from Khan Yunis, where there is no home, no warmth, and no life as you know it. Famine, it's not an emergency in Gaza. It's a part of the landscape, a natural extension of a long siege and a war that has chosen to become used to seeing us suffer. We are not living. We are enduring. When the entire day becomes a struggle to find a single meal, a small details, a cup of tea, the smell of a bread, a tomato, become extraordinary thing, almost like a miracle. We are living a real famine, not metaphorically, but a hunger that grips the gut, turning every meal into a battle and every loaf of bread into a small victory. People race each other for a handful of flour. They stand in the long lines not to buy food, but to search for it. Markets are empty and the shelves mourn themselves. Torn bags and empty boxes have become a daily scene. Vegetables, one or two types, hardly worth mentioning, are sold at a prices beyond belief. A single piece is sold like a pearl in an auction. No fruit, no milk, no eggs, no oil. Everything is rare and everything is expensive, even water. People now cook what's left of lentils as if they are cooking hope. And mothers like me hide our hunger so our children won't see it. Amir, my sons, ask me every day, Mom, when will we eat pizza again? I said soon, and I'll smile at him while my heart breaks piece by piece. Karim doesn't speak much, but he runs after anything that looks like food, as if instinct has outrun language. The loss they are living is more than just the absence of food. It's the absence of life as they knew it, the absence of the love they once felt, and the absence of the hope that once filled their eyes. I spoke not to complain, but to remind you that Gaza is not just a news headline. It's souls waiting for salvation. I'm Duha Latif, and this is not a temporary story. This is my life now.
Duha Latif, a teacher from Gaza, mother of two young children, speaking to us from Khan Yunis in Gaza. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. We end today's show in Memphis, Tennessee, where the family of Tyre Nichols joined supporters to protest and grieve Thursday after jurors Wednesday unanimously acquitted three former Memphis police officers of the murder of Tyre Nichols, a 29-year-old black father who died after the officers brutally beat him during a traffic stop that was caught on video. For more, we go to Memphis. We're joined by Amber Sherman, community organizer, member of the official Black Lives Matter Memphis chapter, and host of the podcast, The Law According to Amber. Welcome back to Democracy Now!, Amber. You were out there with the family yesterday as people held a memorial vigil and protests. Can you respond to the jury's acquittal of the three officers? Not to say they won't serve time in jail, because there were also federal charges that they faced along with other officers.
Yeah, thank you for having me. I think that a lot of us were shocked. I thought they would at least be found guilty on a few charges, but boy, did they prove me wrong. I was like, okay, never mind then. But I do feel like them being found guilty on all of the charges really does embolden the Memphis Police Department.
Acquitted of all the charges.
Yeah, really emboldens them to just, you know, feel like they can do whatever they want, and they can really just leave their body cameras on. It doesn't even matter, because if you see it on camera, they're still going to find you not guilty of the charges and you'll be acquitted.
And can you remind our audience what happened to Tyre when he was just stopped for a traffic stop?
Yeah, so Tyre was stopped by the Scorpion Unit, which is a type of task force here in Memphis. That task force has since been disbanded, but there's similar task force that exists still. So they're still doing these types of stops where they are targeting people in certain types of cars, in certain neighborhoods, specifically black neighborhoods, because they said that they want to target high crime areas. But the area that he was in had only had one homicide in the entire year before. So to me, it looks like they're targeting black people in black neighborhoods. And he was stopped by an officer. He was immediately yanked out of his car and yelled at. He's asking them why they're stopping him. They don't tell him anything. They started hitting him. Their body cameras were still on at that point. And then at some point, he is able to escape them from beating him and runs down the street towards his house. And then they find him on a corner at Castlegate and Ross, which is in Memphis, in East Memphis, and there's a sky cam above him, which are these cameras that the police department used to surveil our neighborhoods, actually. But this sky cam actually had AI technology that helped the camera to move around, so it actually moves as they're beating him. And you can see from multiple angles that multiple officers are kicking him in the head, they're hitting him in the body, they tried to spray him with pepper spray, but sprayed themselves, so then they get even more angrier and continue to hit him. And he is at one point just lifeless, laying there, just being hit. And they're using all the excuses in the world about how, you know, this is their training and he was resisting. But you can clearly see on video that he's not.
I just want to say that the former officers, Tadarius Bean, Demetrius Haley, and Justin Smith, were found not guilty of murder in the state trial. But in a separate federal case, they were found guilty of witness tampering and await sentencing for that conviction. And two others were also convicted on the federal charge and pleaded guilty to state charges, will avoid trial. But they are all possibly expected to serve time in prison. In this last minute that we have, Amber, the response of the family, what they're calling for at this point?
Well, I just want to also add that Demetrius Haley was found guilty of excessive force, deliberate interference for medical intervention, and witness tampering, not just witness tampering. And he's facing up to life in federal prison.
Well, Amber Sherman, I want to thank you so much for being with us. Community organizer, member of the official Black Lives Matter Memphis chapter, host of the podcast, The Law According to Amber. We have 15 seconds, the message from his family.
We want justice for Tyre, and that looks like abolishing the police.
I want to thank you so much for being with us from Memphis, Tennessee. Memphis, Tennessee, where Dr. Martin Luther King was assassinated April 4th. 1968. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is currently accepting applications for a director of technology to lead our broadcast digital IT operations. Learn more and apply at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. This is another edition of Democracy Now!
CJS.